This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems. We've got a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Mark Lerner, Principal of Lerner Enterprises and Vice Chairman and Principal Owner of the Washington Nationals. We also have Bob Coker, Founder, President, and CEO of Ideal Innovations. Jill Stelfox, CFO and Corporate Development of Binary Group. And lastly, Eddie Schwartz, former Chief Marketing Officer of NetWitness and presently Chief Security Officer of RSA. So let's get started with our first guest. I'd like to introduce to you Mark Lerner. Mark is the principal of Lerner Enterprises and the vice chairman and principal owner of the Washington Nationals. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Mike.
What is Lerner Enterprises? We'll start there.
Lerner Enterprises is our family's real estate development company. We also do management and leasing. Started by my father, Ted Lerner, in 1952 with $200 borrowed from my mother, Annette Lerner. And we're going strong today with my dad still at the helm, a strong 85, and moving on to 86 pretty soon.
Incredible. What are some of the signature projects that most people would know?
Certainly, in his younger days, he was the original developer at Tyson's Corner Center in 1968 and Wheaton Plaza in Wheaton, Maryland in 1959. Over the last 20 years, Washington Square, the corner of Connecticut Avenue and L Street, near the Farragut near Farragut Square Metro Station, and we have a lot of new developments going on. We have actually have a new office building we just finished a couple years ago, one block from Nationals Park, right next to the Metro Station.
You know, for most people who know Tyson's Corner, they're familiar with this sign that says, imagine a Tyson's Corner without cars. Yes. Your dad did see a Tyson's Corner without cars.
Well, when he originally bought the ground that Tyson's Corner Center sits on with partners, they bought it before the Beltway was open. And my mother actually thought he was out of his mind, but he's always had great vision, and it's obviously worked out pretty well.
Tell us something that is not obvious about the Washington Nationals, which is, of course, our nation's Capitals baseball team.
Well, our family is very proud of the Nationals, what we've achieved since we bought the team. We've come a long way, but I think the proudest thing is being Washingtonian natives, all of us, and being out there with the Washington Nationals Dream Foundation, be able to do significant works within our community is very important to us. And, you know, it doesn't get a lot of publicity, but there's some great things that my sister, Mara Lerner Tannenbaum, who's chair of it, is putting together right now.
Mark, with Lerner Enterprises, did you always see yourself, you know, working for the family business?
Yes, absolutely. Since I was a little boy, it's all I wanted to do was to work with my dad, and it's always been my total focus, never anything else. And I had literally started it the day after my college graduation and never looked back in 35 years.
Actually, in the green room.
36 years now, actually.
In the green room, you said you started when you were 7 or 8 years old.
Yes.
Tell us about what you were doing with your dad or what your dad brought you along to when you were that age.
Well, I think the one that people will really appreciate is I remember going with him as probably around that age to the site where Tyson's Corner Center is now, when it was just a grassy knoll with some cows walking on it, and the Beltway was under construction, and I remember that very, very vividly, like it was yesterday.
Describe your dad for us.
My dad is an amazing human being, incredible willpower, great shape, mind sharp as a tack. But the greatest thing about the vision that he's had over the years It's unmatched, I think, in great developers who built Washington.
Your dad is famous in this area. Was your dad larger than life in your eyes growing up, or was he just dad, or what was he?
Well, yeah, he's always just dad. I think one of the things that I learned from my father that as hard as he's worked over the years, and he would work incredibly long days, especially when we were growing up, he was always there at the dinner table, even if he went back to the office afterwards. And he was an amazing dad. Yet somebody's built a multi-billion-dollar business along the way too, starting with nothing.
Wow.
Mark, with Lerner, you obviously know a lot about that particular industry, and the opportunity came to bring baseball back to the nation's capital. But in a business that you really didn't have a lot of experience in, and a lot of oversight, there's a commissioner, Major League Baseball. So can you maybe describe and contrast the experience of running a business that you know a lot about versus owning a business that you had no experience with?
Well, there are a lot of similarities, especially with the ballpark itself. I mean, our bread and butter is property management. We're very proud of what we've built there with the city and also maintaining it in a first-class manner. It's as clean and run as well as any ballpark in the United States, for sure. That gives us a lot of joy, and I think it's just as important if you walk in there on March 30th, 2008, when the first game, if you go back to March 30th, 2018, the place is just as good a shape, and, you know, we're always adding things to it. But there's a lot of similarities. Listen, it's a business. You have to run it with the same common sense and good business practices that we run our real estate, the development business. So the fun part, obviously, is the baseball part. That's the cool part. But in reality, it is a business and has to be run efficiently and smart.
So why buy a baseball team?
Well, I think that's just a passion my father and I have had for a long time. We always felt we could do a great job, especially in our hometown, and try to do it the right way, and especially baseball, where we've had so many bad experiences of people leaving with the teams, Griffith and Short, and generations now back. And we just felt that our fans and our fellow Washingtonians needed something that was secure and is going to be run by smart people who have a passion for the game and a passion for the city.
This decision to buy the Nationals was not just yours and your father's, was it? Your sisters had to sign off
on
this, did they not?
My sisters, Deborah Marl, and my brother-in-law, Ed Cohen and Bob Tannenbaum. We did this as a family. My mother was involved. And as we do all of our major decisions with Dad, Bob, Ed, and myself, which has to be majority if we're going to do anything. I mean, not a majority, unanimous. We had the same thing here. If one of us objected, we would not have gone after the Nationals. And I'm sure my sisters did it for me because they know how passionate I am about sports. I'm a sports nut. And Dad, who's always wanted the opportunity to do something and get back to his hometown. So it was an interesting discussion for a period of weeks. But in the end of the day, we've all gone 110% into it, and it's been a great thing for the family, everybody has some role in the organization.
Yeah. Well, the Nationals is more than just giving back to this community. Does it have its own vision? So if you had mentioned 2018 and maybe the vision, you know, for the facility being as pristine as it is today, but what's your vision on the baseball side?
Well, the baseball side, most people know our story. We bought the franchise from Major League Baseball in July 2006. The organization was very poorly run under their tutelage and watch. The farm system, which you depend on, was barren, beyond barren. It had been exploded, and it was below zero. Our first year, it's a funny story, we had to sign actually 22 free agents just to fill out AAA roster.
Wow.
So we were giving something that I felt was actually below an expansion team situation.
Wow.
And we've said we're going to build it in the right way, and what we meant by the right way is we're going to rebuild the farm system, have talent coming out of that system every year, and where necessary, we would bring in free agents to supplement that. And that's the plan we followed to a T. And at this point, we're starting to see the fruits of our labor with Espinoza and Desmond and Wilson Ramos and others, and we're very excited about our future.
So what was it like for you personally the night Steven Strasburg first pitched?
Well, it was. I've been to a lot of sporting events. One of my hobbies is I've always been try to go to sporting events around the world at least one time, and I still got my list of ones I got to get to. But honestly, it was the coolest event I've ever been to. And I've been to Super Bowls, Indianapolis 500, other things. It was a night that many people will never forget. And I've had major announcers who did that game who've done events all over the world and said it was one of the top 10 events he had ever seen. And hopefully when he comes back in a couple of months, he's making great progress. It'll be the same buzz. And next year, it's at some point when Bryce Harper comes, it'll be that same magic. But I don't think anybody can duplicate what they saw that night. Yeah. It was just an amazing evening.
Does your life change at all day to day when something big happens with the Nationals? For example, Jim Riggleman leaving. Does your day-to-day life change? You know, people calling you on the phone, texting you, or is it pretty much the same day-to-day?
You know, funny, when Jim left, it caught us totally by surprise. We had no clue. Obviously, we bounced back, and Mike Rizzo did a wonderful job in the whole situation. But, you know, I'll get notes from my friends. I didn't get a lot of notes that day other than, you know, a couple of people say, wow, what happened? But most of them would get, like, last night after the game saying, you know, what a great game. You know, you guys are living on the edge right now and all those kind of things. But that's fun. I enjoy that. And I love interacting with the fans. That's why I always sit downstairs in most games. And I love talking to the fans. I love hearing what's good about us, about what's bad, things that we can do better. And it's a true joy, but I do love the winning part.
Yeah, I bet. Mark, give us the web address for both Lerner Enterprises and then the Washington Nationals.
Well, Lerner's lerner.com and Nationals are nationals.com.
Yeah, we'd spell Lerner so that everyone gets it.
L-E-R-N-E-R.
And then nationals.com.
Correct.
Great. We've been speaking with Mark Lerner. Mark is the principal of Lerner Enterprises and also the vice chairman and principal owner of the Washington Nationals. I'd like to thank my co-host, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies with your business spotlight. And joining us today is
Jessica Druckman.
Jessica, and what company are you with?
I'm with Concero.
And Jessica, what is Concero?
Concero is a company that puts together events for senior level executives. They're intimate, invitation only, and take place over the course of 2.5 days.
So are these like CEO getaways to Las Vegas kind of things?
Not exactly. We actually say to leave your golf clubs at home. They are serious events. We bring executives together to network with each other, forge new relationships, benchmark, learn new ideas to bring back to their organizations.
Are there specific type of target companies you work with?
We aim for Fortune 1000 companies, the larger organizations for the most part. Most of our events are function-driven, so we put events together for general counsel, CFOs, CIOs, for example.
What do you enjoy most about your job?
What I enjoy most about my job is I have the opportunity to speak with and meet some of the most accomplished people. On top of that, when I'm at the events and meeting people and speaking with them and being in a room with executives all at the same level, sharing ideas and learning from each other, it's an amazing experience. And hearing from them that we've brought value to them, both to their organization and to enhance their career, is truly rewarding.
And Jessica, how can someone reach you?
They can reach me at jdruckman@concero.com. Our website is www.concero.com.
This is Paul with your Business Spotlight. We've been speaking with Jessica from Concero. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guest, Bob Coker. Bob is the founder, president, and CEO of Ideal Innovations. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Mike.
And what is Ideal Innovations?
Simply put, it's like the DOD or the government CSI. We do biometrics, forensics, identity management. We also do scientific research, And we do innovations and inventions for primarily for the Department of Defense.
Can you give us a very specific example?
Well, in the forensics area, we run DNA labs outside the United States and forensics labs. We fingerprint people, and then for DOD, we do the operational maintenance on the DOD system, making matches. And we identify bad people and identify good people.
And you are how big or how small, by whatever metric you want to use, Bob?
We're about 380 people, and all different disciplines. We have a lot of scientists and a lot of folks with patents.
So you guys were CSI long before CSI ever became an acronym.
Right. We hired a lot of people from the FBI and from CSI. A lot of our before it was very large within DOD. The proper side of DOD, we got into this as the enemy changed, as the enemy stopped wearing uniforms, and the enemy started hiding and using bombs. This need arose.
Yeah, and you founded the company when?
In 1998.
Okay, so tell us about the founding of the company.
I was a program manager at DARPA for 6 years, and I was in the military, and I retired. And at DARPA, we worked on finding problems and working on inventions, such as the current body armor, the stuff we did in Somalia back then, and arming Humvees, and different things along that line. And I really liked finding the right problem and trying to develop solutions and test them. So I set up Ideal Innovations basically to do that and started by myself. My wife encouraged me to do this because I like doing this. And of course, when you start out a company, there's not much, there's a lot of financial risk, let me put it that way. And like doing this, and people normally do very well at what they like.
Where did this love or this this inquisitiveness come from? Is this something that, you know, started in childhood somewhere?
Well, yes, when I was real young, I liked working electrical systems, and I built a little polygraph when I was 10 years old. And
polygraph?
Right, a little lie detector, a basic lie detector. And
and who took the test?
Well, family members, and it normally worked pretty well.
Did it shock people?
No, a skin resistance type system. Right. Did that, built little go-karts and different things along that line. And my father was a sergeant in the Army, and his last assignment was at West Point, and saw an opportunity there to go into West Point, and entered West Point.
Going back to your childhood for a moment, did people think you were a normal child?
I think so.
I don't happen to know anybody who built a polygraph, and so really what I'm asking is, what were you like as a child? Because most children don't do that.
My parents really encouraged myself and my two brothers and sisters to do very well in school. We were very encouraged to get straight A's, to be in the National Honor Society and things like that. So we studied very hard, and we liked the I particularly like science and math. And
I'm curious, what form did that encouragement take? What was it? You better do this, or you can do this? What form did it take?
No, it was true encouragement. It was true, you can do this. You know, keep trying until you do it. And it developed, I think, something that has helped me throughout life, persistence, to keep working at something until you get it. It's not, don't try for perfection. Just try to finish something that you set out to do. And I think, I got into marathon running later on in life when I turned 40. I've run 47 marathons since then, and it's all about persistence. It's about trying to finish, and it's a mental discipline.
You had mentioned something interesting about marathon running and how it influences the creative process. Can you describe that a little bit?
Right. When you're running, your heart's beating about 150 beats a minute, and your highly oxygenated blood, and you can think clearer. Now, this is when you're good at running. When you first start out running, that might be the case, but if you're really good at running, it's a great time to think. It's a great time to think about problems. It's a great time to think about innovation.
If you don't mind my asking on the air, how old are you?
I'm 57.
You've run 47 marathons in 17 years.
Well, I haven't run in the last 4 years.
Okay. You've run 47 right, marathons right. in 13 years.
Right. It was once you're trained to that level, it's good. It's easy.
Well, doing the math, how many marathons is that a month?
Oh, the most you can run is one every other month. The most I've ever done at one time is 8 in a year, and 3 to 8 in a year.
Wow.
Growing up, you know, I guess, you know, and being a you know, a baby boomer, there was a lot of good influences, I think, in the media. I think I just go back to myself, you know, James Bond and Man from U.N.C.L.E. Were you influenced, you know, at all by a lot of what was going on in TV with NASA, 2001, A Space Odyssey? Did that influence you at all?
I think a lot in the military. My dad was in the military. My background was military. I liked the military, and once I got into it, really looking at the significant problems that the military has because the threat keeps changing, and it's very challenging. And as of today, well, as of early this year, I went to a foreign country there, sent by DOD to figure out some issues to look at it, and we keep doing that.
You had mentioned that your sense of the key to inventiveness is finding the right problem and then solving it. One example of that is a problem you developed and most men develop when they run marathons. So tell us about that.
That's correct. You want to find a problem and solve it. And in this particular case, when you train for a marathon, guys get a particular abrasion problem from the sweat on their shirts. And we came up with a little invention called Nip Guards and patented it, licensed it to a company. And they've been selling them for 10 years. They're in every running store in the U.S., and they sold over 3 million of them.
Bob, a lot of people would think that somebody who's a natural inventor and maybe even somebody who runs marathons might not have a lot of social skills, but you are very much a people person, aren't you? Especially with respect to, you know, your employee base, that's many of which are overseas.
Well, the key to the success are the employees. We hire great people. I look to hire people that are smarter than me. I look to hire people that are aggressive, and I like to get them in the positions where they are very comfortable with and what they like doing. If you get people doing what they like doing, they'll do very well. I think a lot of our folks like adventure. Our folks are innovative, and we emphasize persistence to get things done. We encourage people, and our people normally that do join us stay with us for a long period of time.
You have folks in both Iraq and Afghanistan. How often do you get over there to see your people?
I've been to Iraq 16 times, Afghanistan 8 times. And part of it is for DOD looking at different problems, but part of it is meeting with our folks on the ground. A lot of times it's their first time over there and working with them, seeing what their problems are and encouraging them, and also assessing to make sure that they're not too much in harm's way.
I think being influenced a lot by the military, you know, you have a sense of mission. Do your frequent trips to Iran and Afghanistan help reinforce that sense of mission?
Yes. The enemy is changing quickly. And when you look at our soldiers over there, people 18, 19 years old, first time deployed, the things that they go through to work, to see, to build things, to help identify bad guys, it's a sense of accomplishment. And I think all our senior management in the company really focus on that.
When I think of inventors, I think of Thomas Edison, and most people consider him to be a genius. Are you a genius?
No. I hire people that are smarter than me. But I will put in one thing. You mentioned Thomas Edison. The two most creative times for solving problems and coming up with ideas are the 30 minutes before you go to sleep, when you're laying in bed, and the 30 minutes as you're waking up. That's when you're rested, creative. That's what Thomas Edison said, and that is a good time to think about problems.
How do you apply that? What do you do during the 30 minutes before you get before you go to bed and just when you arise?
Well, you set your alarm and you don't jump out of bed right away. You know, it goes off, and then you kind of think about what's going to happen that day, and when you go to sleep, what bothered you that night, and you think about that.
So you've had some great ideas occur in those two time periods.
Right, mostly solving problems. Solving problems, something in the company that you're trying to figure out, and sometimes you can get things there. But a lot of the creativity was during the marathon running periods or along that time.
Can the quote-unquote average person be inventive and creative, and if so, how?
Well, it's the answer is absolutely yes, and it's basically something that bothers you to think about how would this be better. And then the first approach is probably not the right. Then think of different ways, but stay with the problem until you can kind of figure out an answer. It's about solving problems. It's about making things easier. And a lot of times you sit down, what bothered me this week? And to try to find things.
Yeah. Bob, would you give us the web address, please, for Ideal Innovations?
It's www.idealinnovations.com.
We've been speaking with Bob Coker, founder, president, and CEO of Ideal Innovations. I'd like to thank my co-host, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. I'm Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Tim Keim.
And Tim, you're with whom?
Leadership Greater Washington.
And what is that?
We connect business leaders from business, government, nonprofit, get them collectively working together on issues facing Greater Washington.
Okay. There's a lot of organizations that sound like they do that. How is yours different?
Well, we focus on regional issues, focusing on making sure folks that work together should work together. We really believe in the power of relationships, so I'm kind of a matchmaker of folks who have influence, and we really kind of inspire their collaborative efforts.
So people or companies who would need that sort of help, give us some examples.
Well, anyone from a nonprofit CEO who's kind of siloed needs to connect with other folks, a business leader who has the ability to make change, or a government official needs to know more about what's going on, not just in his or her jurisdiction, but across Greater Washington.
Okay. Can you give us a success story?
Let me use the Fishing School. It's a nonprofit that helps folks in Northeast Washington focus on boys and girls getting after-school services. They were about ready to go under, but because their leader was in Leadership Greater Washington, got connected with business folks who transformed the organization, came in, did a business plan, did a marketing plan, communications plan, and now the organization has touched thousands more lives as a result.
Tim, what is your web address?
www.lgwdc.org.
We've been speaking with Tim Keim of Leadership Greater Washington. My name is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guest, Jill Stelfox, CFO and Corporate Development for Binary Group. Welcome, Jill. And what is Binary Group?
We are a government contractor. We have about 125 employees, and we do strategy work for the government.
And can you give us an example that most people could relate to?
Yeah. So one of our largest projects is working with the Army. The Army is going through this process where they need to be auditable. And so we are helping them implement the financial systems that they need in order to do an audit. And as a taxpayer, I think it's a great thing that the Army is going to be auditable soon.
So in other words, up until now, the Army was unable to be audited.
Yes.
And that means what exactly?
It means that in terms of the financial controls that we all think about in our homes, you know, where we put our money, where we spend our money, we know where we spend it, and we know how much we have at any given time, and we know how much stuff costs. And the Army obviously is huge, and they have a lot of moving parts. And so being able to track all that money from when they get it from taxpayers to how they spend it is been a tough thing to do. And soon, within the next 2 years, they'll be able to be audited.
That sounds like a huge job.
It's a huge job. It is absolutely the right thing to do for the Army and for taxpayers, so we can all know where the money's going.
Yeah, that's very important work, and thank you for doing it. CFO, Chief Financial Officer, I think most people know what that means. What does corporate development mean?
Corporate development means mergers and acquisitions. So buying other companies and integrating them into what Binary does and creating a larger company.
Well, what in the world do you know about growing companies and merging companies and selling companies?
In my past life before Binary, I was a venture capital backed CEO. And I ran technology companies. So I would go out and raise venture capital money from investors, grow a company from scratch, and then sell it.
Yeah, so we're going to put some numbers to this. You were part of a group of women that are less than, let me say this again, less than 4% of the women business owners in this country have done what?
Raised venture capital money. In fact, when I raised the first venture capital money on my own in 2003, $7.5 million, we were the largest woman-run deal in the United States, and there were only 84 other women in the country in 2003 that raised money. And I say that because I think women are fabulous at running companies.
Yeah.
And have all of the skills to raise venture capital, and I just wish there were more of us.
Wow. To put some additional numbers to this, you have turned $50 million raised into how much?
$1 billion.
Wow. How do you do that?
It is a lot of hard work. First of all, being a CEO is not a glamorous job. You get to do everything. I laugh all the time. It's chief cook and bottle washer. So you get to make copies. You get to make copies. You get to make coffee. You get to hire and fire. So it's a lot of work. But the key thing for me has been surrounding myself with amazing people and asking for help from amazing people.
You had mentioned before joining your friend at Binary Group, you actually had the unusual experience of getting fired from a job. So can you describe that a little bit?
The only job I was fired from was a stint at motherhood. So when I sold my last company in 2008, I decided that it would be a great time to take some time off of work. And I had never been a stay-home mom. And I thought, well, how much fun would that be to spend great time with my kids, except that they were 14 and 15, which is just the right time.
Lovely. Lovely stage.
They're not looking for parental supervision, so they were not exactly excited. And I have a bit of a type A personality. So between type A-ing our house through social schedules and repair work and new cooking, you know, they were like, listen, you need to channel this in some other place but here. So they let me understand that maybe being a mom right now was not a good thing.
Well, let's go back to when you were young. Who was the influential person in your life who made you believe in yourself?
You know, it really was my parents, and more specifically, my dad. I was lucky enough to be raised in a family of four girls. My father was a teacher. My mother was also a teacher and a great stay-home mom. So we didn't have a lot of money. My dad absolutely believed in education, and he was, I just always remember him being our biggest cheerleader and telling us, hey, listen, you've got to do something amazing. First of all, you can, you need to, you're going to go to college and you're going to take care of yourself. It's going to be great.
Okay. There were two quotes he gave us in the green room. One is, quote, you can't ever rely on your man. On a man, that was your father saying that, and you will get a license to do something.
That's
end
exactly
quote.
Right.
Tell us about those quotes.
So my dad believed in education, and he thought, look, if you go to college, then you will absolutely be able to take care of yourself. And in a world where, and he saw this coming, where, you know, 50% of the jobs would be woman run, this is a great time for women to really take control of their financial well-being and their lives. And so he was great at pushing us to do that. So my older sister's a nurse. I became a licensed CPA. And my two younger sisters got those silly computer degrees at the time and have done really, really well.
Yeah, so it's never dawned on you that you anything that you set out to do that you would possibly fail at, right?
No. So the way I look at failure, and I think it's a lot of the reason why maybe women think that they shouldn't go into venture capital is they think, oh my gosh, not a lot of women have done it. Maybe it won't happen for me. But here's another way to think about it. You don't have the money now, so you have nothing to lose by going and doing it. You can do, and it's so funny, it's how I think about everything. I might as well just give it a try because I'm not climbing a mountain now, so it doesn't matter if I can't later because I'm not doing it now. You know, I might as well raise venture capital money. All they can say is no, and I have no money now anyway. So, okay.
Did your farm girl experience when you were 13 have anything to do with this attitude?
I think my sassy attitude was only brought out more during that. When I was 13, I got the opportunity. I guess it might have been crazy, but I got the opportunity to go away for the entire summer. I had to write an application to be able to do that so that I could get the funding to go. And I won it, and I got to spend the summer in Wichita, Kansas, being a farm girl, which for me was a blast. I had no idea how to bale hay or wake up so early in the morning and all of the things that go into farming. And it was a great learning experience. And I did it all by myself. No family members, no one with me on the airplane, no one with me the whole time. And it was really fun.
And the impact that had on you is what?
It taught me that I could really do anything that I wanted to do. Like, I wasn't worried about whether I could or couldn't do something. I could manage my own self, and I could achieve whatever I wanted, even if I didn't know how. Like, I don't know how to bale hay, but I asked somebody, how do you do it? And they taught me how to do it, and sure enough, I can actually bale hay now. Who knew?
You had said that women running companies have an advantage in that they don't feel the same constraints against asking for help.
I think it's a huge advantage that women have, that we don't have. When we ask men for help, they generally help us. And it's a huge advantage. Men, I think, sometimes feel uncomfortable asking for help, like it might reflect badly on them. But we as women, it's the exact opposite response. The more, sort of the higher placed the gentleman is in his career, the more likely they are to help a woman out. And I think it's a tremendous advantage that we have and should use. It's been hugely helpful to me in my career.
We had talked about the issue of trust. I mean, you work with your best friend. There has to be a tremendous amount of trust between the two of you. And asking for help, is there a sixth sense that you have or that you think you have to have in order to determine whether or not somebody you can trust?
I think you do. And I think you have to ask for help a lot to get to that position of knowing what's good advice and what's bad advice. The other big advantage that women have is that sort of intuition, sixth sense. Mm-hmm. And it really applies. I think it applies all the time in business. If your gut feel is it's a good idea, it's a good idea. If your gut feel isn't right, it's not a good idea.
Is your dad aware of just how successful you've been?
You know, he is. He actually passed away about 5 years ago from cancer, but he got to attend award ceremonies with me all over the world, and that for him was amazing, absolutely amazing.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Jill, would you give us the web address for Binary Group, please?
It's www.binarygroup.com.
Would you spell that for us?
BinaryGroup.
Perfect. We've been speaking with Jill Stelfox, Chief Financial Officer and Corporate Development for Binary Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, Phil Pereggi of Saber Systems, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. This is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is?
Frank McMillan.
And Frank, who are you with?
A company called PeopleShare.
PeopleShare. Well, what is that?
We're a full-service staffing company.
And what does full-service mean?
Well, we work with people for clerical, admin, light industrial. We're specialized in the legal side, call center staffing.
Given the economy, are people still using staffing companies right now?
Absolutely. We are growing tremendously right now.
So a typical customer for you would be who?
A lawyer's office, any call center, manufacturing facility that is growing or needs to hire some new individuals.
Yeah. Can you give us a success story?
Well, we have a lot of success stories. One of them is just a lot of the people that come into our office just don't interview well. And they just don't have the opportunity to get in to a location, and we give them that first step into the facility. So it kind of gives them a helping hand to get into a premier company, and then they see their work values and ethics, and then they hire them on as a full-time employee.
Why do you feel this is such important work to do?
Well, I really enjoy this because both sides of the customer, the company that I am recruiting for, and the employees that come in, both benefit tremendously from the efforts that I do. So it's very important.
Are there particular types of clients that you look for?
Light industrial and manufacturing are some very important clients, but call center work is very nice too.
Frank, would you give us your website, please?
It is PeopleShareWorks.com. That's www.peopleshareworks.com.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems. And I'd like to introduce to you our final guest of the day, Eddie Schwartz. Eddie is the former Chief Marketing Officer of NetWitness and presently the Chief Security Officer of RSA. And I would like to add, is joined in the studio by his son, Merritt. So welcome, Merritt and Eddie. And Eddie, tell us, what is NetWitness?
NetWitness is a network security company. Our focus is helping organizations, whether they're federal government agencies, banks, energy companies, find the things on their network that they're just not seeing today, whether they're cyber criminals or nation-sponsored attackers or hacktivists or something like that, basically finding the unknown attackers.
What's a hacktivist?
Hacktivists are these groups like LulzSec or Anonymous that you may have heard of that are hacking organizations like the Senate, the CIA, that basically have some sort of agenda, maybe a grudge or a political agenda, and are just in there for some reason that maybe we don't even understand sometimes.
And your job is to do what with that?
So with this network security software, what we're trying to do is really bring the fight back to the enemy, help organizations like these government agencies and banks get ahead of where the enemy is, because the enemy is more sophisticated than ever. They're using really advanced techniques. And so what we're doing is, in a world where everyone is really living in compromise today, really living with these attacks, whether they like it or not, we're helping them get better visibility into those attacks, see the unknown. Something new happens tomorrow. How do you figure it out? Take the fight back to the enemy.
How big or small is NetWitness by whatever metric you want to use?
So NetWitness, when it was acquired by EMC Corporation April 1st, was about 130 employees and took us about 4.5 years to get there.
Okay. Let's go back 4 years. You had mentioned that 4 years ago, and these were your words, quote, you were bored with the security industry, end quote. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the things about security is about 10 years ago, it had really turned into this policy-driven, really boring thing where people were running around with checklists, everybody doing the same thing. And what I started to realize is that same thing wasn't working. We're seeing attacks all over the place, viruses all over networks, consumers like you and me having their machines toasted by criminals and their identities stolen. And so I was really frustrated with that fact. And then along came this technology, and all of a sudden I realized there was the potential to change the game in network security.
What were you doing when the NetWitness technology came along?
So I was chief technology officer at a local area government contractor called Mantech International. And the NetWitness technology actually existed there at the time. And a group of investors came along. My boss, Amit Uran, came and said, hey, why don't we take this and spin it out, start a company, and change the way people think about security.
Was there some eureka moment, some sort of epiphany when you said, this is it?
Yes. When we started talking about, hey, let's really change this landscape. Let's really introduce this idea of turning security on its head, getting people to focus on the crown jewels and getting them to focus on the adversary and stop checking boxes and look at their network differently. That's when I said, we can do this. We can really change the way people are thinking about this. And that's what we did in 4 years.
Hey, can you talk a little bit about where your interest in the industry and in this field came from?
Well, I think a lot of it started back, frankly, when I was a kid. I went to Jesuit schools for 12 years, and having gone to Jesuit schools, part of what they do is teach you to be an investigator of sorts. You're inquisitive. You challenge everything. You take religious training, but then they send you off to all other religions and tell you question everything we just taught you. And I think I've taken that throughout my whole life. If somebody tells you, hey, this is the way you do security, you sort of immediately question that and you say, well, why are we doing it this way? Especially when, as I said to you earlier, if you're living in compromise and it's not working, why should we continue to do it this way? So I think throughout my life, I've always had this investigative mindset and this mindset that let's introduce conflict into any environment and let's get people to seek whatever the real truth about a certain issue might be.
Tell us a little bit more about the Jesuit school. How old were you when you were there? Did it feel right, or was it something that you had to learn and to change, to think differently? Tell us more.
Well, I think the seminal moments were my high school education, because I went to a school in New York City called Regis High School, which a lot of people know, and it's a Jesuit school in New York City. It was all really smart kids, and there was a lot of pressure to always produce things that were different. For example, if you had a theology class, it was like, okay, don't believe what you see in the New Testament. Let's do something different. Go out and go to synagogue for a while. Go attend services at some other religion. And when you think about someone who's supposed to be teaching you how to be a good Catholic, for example, that's telling you, what you should do is go study Zen Buddhism for 6 months and bring back the goodness of that into your life and try to synthesize that with everything else you know, that's a whole different way of thinking about things than most people are trained.
This sounds like a whole different way of life from the Bronx, which is where you lived when you were young. Tell us about life and school in the Bronx.
So life in the Bronx was interesting because I grew up in a neighborhood where, let's just say I was challenged. You get home from school and it was a question of getting up to your apartment before you'd get ambushed and potentially have your school bucks taken and thrown down the hall or whatever. So I would at first seek protection from one of the local gangs or whatever. But after a few years, this was the era of Bruce Lee.
You would find protection by doing what?
Well, I would do their homework. I was a smart kid, so you do their homework, you do whatever, help them with their tests or whatever. But this was the era of Bruce Lee, and I was a big fan. And they said, hey, instead of having us protect you all the time, why don't you take a martial arts class? So I enrolled in martial arts at an age that where my son is right now, and I've been studying martial arts ever since. And I had this sort of moment when I was 14 where I finally took on the bully of the neighborhood in front of everybody in the whole neighborhood and beat him in front of everyone. And after that, we were all friends. I mean, things aren't exactly like that these days, as you well know, but that was how you resolve things in those days.
That incident reminds me of something you said in the green room, and I'll quote. You said that it's important to embrace conflict as a means to communicate. What do those two things have to do with each other, martial arts and conflict?
I think
and communicating.
So when you have conflict, there's always a path that's painful, and then there's a path of resolution. And the path that's painful ultimately doesn't lead anyone to any place of mutual benefit, let's put it that way, right? I mean, if you don't go to conflict, you're never going to resolve anything. If you go to conflict and there's just pure pain for everyone, where do you get? So with martial arts, part of what I learned is that if you can introduce the right kind of conflict, there's a magic that occurs where both of you come to a conclusion that ultimately redirects the good energy of both people to a positive outcome. And I know that sounds a bit amorphous, but as a martial arts conflict, as a martial arts principle, what happens is that you learn a path together that ultimately is mutually beneficial. And that concept has a lot of business applications.
It's interesting. So most of your career and life, really, you know, you've been sort of like, you know, the challenger of paradigms, you know, the challenger of previously stated truths. Now, when you come to NetWitness, now you're in the position of being a principal. Is it hard for you to maybe be the one on the receiving end of, you know, somebody, you know, in your organization maybe challenges the way that you're thinking?
No, I welcome that. I think part of what you have to do to create a successful culture in an organization is create a culture of transparency and truth. Because if you assume that, for example, you know, in my position or any position at the top, that you somehow know everything or you're smarter than everyone else or your way is the only way, you're never going to be successful. So if what you're doing is ultimately saying to everyone, listen, any of you can introduce some aspect of what the ultimate truth is, any of you can introduce conflict, any of you can essentially say there are things that are missing from this equation, you're going to get to where you need to be faster. And so that's what we encourage the NetWitness. And, you know, in some cases, in my example, I mean, I would work on a project for weeks only to have it challenged by my peers. But those challenges ultimately had a better result for everybody. So you check your ego at the door. Very hard for a lot of people to do that, but that makes for a successful organization. And once you get used to working that way, you realize that it's not about ego. It's about the success of the company and about the success that we're creating for all our families together.
So is pursuit of truth the ultimate sort of like ideal, you know, that idealistic value, I guess, that comes out of this?
I think it is. And, you know, we linked that same idea, that cultural value, to our technology. Because if you think of what we were doing with our technology at NetWitness, we were basically capturing all of this data that crossed the wire. And we didn't know what the adversaries were going to do tomorrow. But we could always go back and look and say, you know, just like an HD video camera, what did they do? Give me the evidence that showed some new attack, some new thing that an adversary was perpetrating. Ultimately, the truth was there, even if we didn't understand what it was at the time.
Are you a revolutionary?
I suppose in some respects I am a revolutionary. That's a great question. I definitely look for opportunities to work in areas where I can be a game changer, where I can make a difference, where I can introduce change. So yes, I would say yes.
Would you give us the web address, please?
The web address is www.netwitness.com or www.rsa.com in our new world.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Eddie Schwartz, the former chief marketing officer of NetWitness and presently the chief security officer at RSA. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Mark Lerner, principal of Lerner Enterprises and vice chairman and principal owner of the Washington Nationals, Bob Coker, founder, president, and CEO of Ideal Innovations, Jill Stelfox, CFO and corporate development for Binary Group, and of course, most recently, Eddie Schwartz, former chief marketing officer for NetWitness and the chief security officer at RSA. I'd like to thank my co-host, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems, for helping me with the interviews. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, our audience. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. We've been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, at Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.